secrets will eat you up. You feel so alone.
I want to be able to speak the truth. As loud as I had to speak the lie for so long.
I mean, this was just the most magical thing I'd ever seen. And that first night, Michael just kind of took us on a little bit of a tour, and he said to me and my sister, you can stay in one of the guest rooms, or you can stay in here with me if you want. And my reaction was, of course I want to stay with you. We had one more night that way that myself and my family were going to leave and go on another kind of vacation to the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. I was devastated to leave Michael. Michael was devastated for me to leave. He actually sobbed.
So you got to stay.
So I got to stay. And so it was just Michael and I in Neverland for the next week.
And your parents allowed that?
My parents allowed that. Mm-hmm. Within either the first or second night of Michael and I being alone at Neverland, the night started changing.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. With me today is
Nora Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds.
Yeah, everybody has. Everybody's sighing, right?
You know, today we're going to be talking about a documentary that has really taken the world by storm. It's an HBO documentary called Leaving Neverland, and I am just still shaking from watching it. So why don't you go ahead, Jim?
All right. Well, first of all, I think we can all say that this is a very disturbing documentary. And it's disturbing for a number of reasons and on a number of levels. For me, someone who is extremely familiar with the case of Gavin Arvizo and Jordy Chandler, to see the details of what else was going on right around that same time, and to know that law enforcement did not have access to that information at the time, it wrenches my heart. Because I know what Gavin went through, and I know the kinds of things that Jordy Chandler went through, and how much they've been vilified by a billion people around the world who consider themselves Michael Jackson fans. It just tears me apart to know that this information was out there, but it was unattainable at the time. I'm not in any way, shape, or form blaming Wade Robson or Jimmy Safechuck. They are very credible victims of child sexual victimization, which has an array of difficulties associated with it. And the fact that they had the bravery to come forward in this documentary is incredibly encouraging to me and to millions and millions of victims across this country and around the world. And I applaud them for it. I just wish that we had this information earlier, back in 2004, or 1993 for that matter, because I believe if that were the case, Michael Jackson would be alive today and he would be in prison.
Wow. Well, as we know, Jim, you know, when victims disclose, it's just such a journey for them and one that continues. And I think that when people decide to disclose abuse, it tends to be different for everybody.
And right.
There were so many protective factors that Michael Jackson had put in place to entrap these young boys and to ensure their silence. And we have to remember that this was a megastar who not only groomed and coercively controlled young boys, he also controlled their families and he groomed us too. You know, we all fell into the spell of this megastar.
Yes.
It's only from watching Leaving Neverland and going back to the press conferences that he gave that I realized how clever he was in terms of his manipulation tactics. And so if he manages to do that to everyone else around him, what chance really did these little boys stand when they didn't have the vocabulary, they didn't understand it as abuse? And perhaps the word abuse we should think about that, because this is almost like seduction, isn't it? This awful, horrible, twisted and insidious seduction where these guys didn't stand a chance.
No, it's a game of psychological warfare. I mean, what he did to these families, I mean, the physical abuse is horrible enough, but what he did to the women, to the mothers, what he did to those relationships, and you know, we're going to get into all of this, but we should probably back up and say that Leaving Neverland is a documentary by the filmmaker Dan Reed, who's British, and you know, his work before this was very different. You know, he was in war zones, and his previous documentary was 3 Days of Terror, the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and frontline fighting, battling ISIS. But he, in this documentary, he comes across a whole other monster in the form of Michael Jackson. But he would say that this is a film about two victims of a serial pedophile, and not necessarily about Michael Jackson, but it's their story.
And that's a good way to shape it, because it is their story. It gives them, just like Real Crime Profile, we attempt to give the victims their voice back. I think that Dan Reed did the same thing for Wade Robson and Jimmy Safechuck. And it took them many years. And it took them together to have the confidence and the courage and the ability to come forward and fully disclose in all its gory detail what happened to them, what they suffered through at the hands of Michael Jackson. And as a result of that bonding that these two young men made with each other, they were able to do what we saw in this documentary, which is lay out in incredible detail how they were brought into this, how they were manipulated into a vulnerable position, how the grooming, just think about it. So Wade was a dancer. And he won a dance competition. And Jimmy Safechuck was an actor, a boy actor in a commercial, a Pepsi commercial, where Michael Jackson shows up and puts on Michael's clothes and his hat. And he's very taken by Michael Jackson. But in both of those cases, these were actually events that I'm certain Michael Jackson had a hand in fashioning. In other words, did you, when you were young, Lisa or Laura, hear about Michael Jackson having competitions for people who were 19 or 25 or 28 or 40, who were incredibly good dancers and actors and performers, and then were actually brought on stage with Michael Jackson or put in a commercial with Michael Jackson? I would venture to say that you didn't hear that, because Michael Jackson brought children on stage with him, because he had competitions for children to get these spots. Small children, boys, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. Not 19, 20, 21-year-olds. But there were plenty of incredibly gifted, talented dancers and actors who could have competed for those same roles. But Michael wanted access to boys. And that's one of the insidious things that I want people to understand. This didn't just happen as a result of them winning contests or getting this part on this commercial. Michael had a hand in creating the contest and creating that commercial. And so that is why Wade ended up being a victim of Michael Jackson. And that is why Jimmy ended up being a victim of Michael Jackson. I am certain that when Jimmy Safechuck was picked for that commercial, it wasn't without the consent of Michael Jackson. And I'm certain that when Michael found out that Wade was this 7-year-old boy who wasn't even old enough to compete, but because he was so good and so young.
He was 5 years old when he started. Yeah, he was 5 years old. He was young. Yeah.
Right.
So the grooming begins even before.
Right.
I think Wade makes that point, but I think that's what you're basically characterizing, that he set the stage and he basically was grooming prior to the meeting. And I think what Dan Reed does particularly well, I don't know if you both feel this, but the chronology, the journey that he takes us on, helps us really understand that grooming process.
Yes.
He starts from the beginning, yeah.
Beat by beat. I've never seen it laid out like that. And it's so compelling. It's the silence in the spaces and just the interviews that are so quiet. And, oh, my goodness, the accounts that are just so raw and you can see and feel the pain.
Absolutely.
And Dan Reed supports it by not only what the men are saying, but the contemporaneous photos that are of the time that are exactly of what these boys are describing. And these photos are not only from, personal photos from the boys, but, you know, media photos. So it's everything that they're saying, step by step, you can see evidence of.
There's right. And there's one thing, because every now and then you could hear Dan in the background ask them a question. And there's one thing that I kind of cringed at. And I hope that over the course of the rest of the documentary series, that was kind of repaired. And that when, I think it was Wade who said, it could have been Jimmy, I'm not sure, but maybe you guys will remember, where one of them said, and so, you know, I'm just a little kid. And now I'm like on stage with Michael Jackson, and now I'm his best friend. And then Dan Reed said, and lover.
Oh.
And he said, yeah, and lover. And I just cringed, because what that made it sound like was that this was an age-appropriate sexual relationship between two equal partners, when it was a very extremely abusive and manipulative crime that was being committed against that young boy. And so I just want our listeners to understand that there's a significant difference between lovers and someone who is being sexually victimized. Although that little boy who was 7 years old, or that little boy who was 10 years old at the time, basically loved Michael Jackson, fell in love with Michael Jackson even, put up with what happened to them because they loved Michael Jackson. They were being sexually victimized. Crimes were being committed against them over and over and over again. And that is a significant difference between being a victim of child sex crimes and being someone's lover.
Yeah.
We have to remember that Michael was reinforcing this with telling them that it was love. This is the way that love is communicated. And he's schooling them and grooming them and saying that God brought them together and that these are acts of love. Now, how does a little boy, age 7, understand any different? You know, you take that trust, because a child trusts an adult, and in particular when it's someone like Michael Jackson, their idol, and then you're seeing the world reinforce that Michael Jackson is a good guy. He's meeting Princess Diana. He's meeting President Ronald Reagan, all these people that reinforce that he's a good person. So that love, and I'm going to call it love bombing, the things that he bestows upon those boys, it's the same kind of love bombing that we see in coercive control situations. He gives them all these things that are any little boy's dream, and that's what the tools that he uses. And I think when I saw, I don't know if either of you saw the Martin Bashir interview with Michael Jackson in 2003.
Yes.
Yeah, 90 minutes long. Well, there are two things there are many things that jumped out in my head. But one of them was the fact that he said that the most loving thing you can do is share a bed with someone. Well, a grown man sharing a bed with a child that is not theirs.
It's outrageous.
Is outrageous. And of course, you know, lots of people struggle with why did the mothers let them, but he was Michael Jackson. And so all the tools that he used to groom the children, he groomed others, but their alarm bell should have been ringing because he chose to disclose that. Now, the second thing is that he also insisted he'd only ever had 2 surgeries. Well, it was clear that he was lying about that too.
Right.
He is duping in so many ways, but an adult sharing a bed with a child that's not there, creating a Neverland, a fantasy land for children, aimed at children, to target children. Well, here's a paedophile, here's a sex offender on a grand scale. And yet people just are still not awake to that.
And one thing that really struck me about this documentary was, even though I had actually participated in this investigation in 2004, 2005, I was not aware of all the different places at Neverland that Michael would sexually victimize kids.
Oh my God, that and, list. Oh.
Right. He said, oh, in the train house. Oh, in upstairs in the attic. Oh, in that room over here. Oh, in the game room. Oh, I mean, there over.
In every room.
There were yes.
bedrooms attached to it.
I have no doubt in my mind that Michael had a hand in putting those beds in those exact locations for their privacy, for the fact that they could easily get kids there in the middle of play and they can take advantage of them sexually.
Are you frightened or thinking this is weird or wrong?
No, it's in the context of a loving, close relationship. There's no alarm bells going off in your head or any thoughts like that. Really, it's just, I love this person we're trying to make each other happy. He said, I was his first, but even as a kid, you don't even know what that means.
I want to talk about the difference in mode between how Michael Jackson victimized Jimmy as opposed to how he victimized Wade. It seemed like with Jimmy, which was earlier abuse than Wade, he had a long game in mind. And the documentary really lays out the seduction of the parents. You know, how Michael Jackson goes to their house and sits on the floor in their living room and plays and slums it basically to be with this family and makes them feel special and makes it feel like he's another one of the mom's kids, you know, and this seduction of the entire family. And then slowly, you know, the Jimmy brings toys to Michael Jackson and just infiltrates this family.
Yeah, but remember, it's a double manipulation because he is making them feel special, but he's also saying that they are helping him.
Right.
Manipulation.
No, I mean, did they go to Hawaii together? But it's a long game. It's a long time until there is finally that physical contact. I think it was finally when they went to Paris together and that's when the physical contact started. As opposed to Wade, it's like, the first day he has this kid alone in Neverland. So he has this accelerated process with Wade.
And part of that could be how he has learned in between, how he has developed. And also, you have to understand that offenders develop a sixth sense for being able to assess vulnerability. Now remember, Wade is 3 years younger. Yeah. So that's 3 years easier because Wade is 3 years less mature, 3 years less big, 3 years less powerful, 3 years less sophisticated. So it's easier for Michael to manipulate Wade and to keep him quiet. Whereas Jimmy was 10 and he was a little more mature, a little more. And so Michael has to deal with each one of those factors for each one of his victims. And plus, these are two guys and you can't take them completely out of context because Michael had access to other people as well, other children as well. And you don't know where he was at the different stages with those people. And what we call it is a grooming pipeline. And it's very common for offenders, repeat serial offenders, to groom a number of children at the same time so that when they are actually vulnerable and available and desirable, they take advantage of them. And when they get them to that vulnerability place where they know they're confident that they're not going to disclose and they're going to sort of be tacitly agreeing to the victimization, then they move forward with that person. And they continue to groom other kids so that when they're done with this one, and we saw this, and we'll see this more in the second half, but when they're done with that kid, they move on to someone else and someone else and someone else.
I have a question, and it's one of the worst questions I've ever had to ask, and I don't even know how to ask this. But Jim, since you worked with child sex trafficking, I'm going to ask you this. So with the means that Michael Jackson has, you know, there are some dark places in the world where he could go and, you know, buy a child prostitute. I mean, not a child prostitute. He'd buy a child. Very direct transaction.
I bought two kids undercover in New York City.
Right.
You don't have to go too dark.
Right. But what I'm saying is He could do that, which would be horrific in itself, but that's not what he wants. He wants to put it over on the family. He wants the...
He wants to hold it out to the world.
Explain that. Wants, that is he, that adrenaline? Does he, that he's getting over on these families?
No. I think it's something totally different. I think it's him wanting to integrate these people into his life. He knows that if he went down to Times Square at 3 a.m. and talked to some seedy guy in an alley and bought a kid for sex, that he knows he's doing something illegal and wrong. What he wants to do is rationalize. Mm-hmm. I am helping these families. I am helping these children. I love them. And that's right. Why his denial was never a denial. It was a protest.
Yeah.
I would never hurt a child. I love children. That is not a denial. He didn't say when he was accused, I have never had any sexual contact with any child. I have never let any child have sexual contact with me. He never said those words. What he mm-hmm. said was, I would never hurt a child.
Yeah.
How many times have you seen that, Jim? I mean, I've seen and heard that so many times that I would, and they don't, you know, articulate it in the way that it's about hurting. And I'm also glad that you brought up vulnerability. I just want to circle back to that point because I don't want to lose it. I'm glad that you brought that up because every person has a different level of vulnerability. We all do. It doesn't matter who we are, and certainly with children too. And a vulnerability could be as simple as Wade Robson being 5 and idolizing Michael Jackson. You know, and it's that ability to exploit and use and get leverage on the thing that matters the most to someone. And Michael Jackson, unfortunately, did that particularly well. He zeroed in on those things under the guise of, I'm helping, I love children, I would never harm them. You know, I'm doing all these things to help you. And so the conflict they create is that the child, of course, adores them. They see what they're doing as love. They don't see it as anything different. And so that language for what happens sexually, because I think what the documentary showed particularly well, and I'm going to put a caveat on it here because I'm going to talk about the sexual acts, but was that grooming process of the sexual acts, of things that were gradual, of touching, that then moves to other acts. And I think that some of the most poignant parts are unfortunately where the now men have to describe what had happened to them. The acts were subtle to begin with, his compliancy testing and checking, and there wasn't penetration right from the start. And even down to where I think it's Wade describes that he would then make him go to the end of the bed and he would make his butt cheeks, his bottom cheeks,
and
sit there masturbating. That was so, you could see he was back there. And that image, you know, he could have chosen any type of physical act, which tells me that that was authentic, that was true in that account. And I would imagine if you look at every one of those boys' accounts, their statements, they would be very, very similar in terms of the actual grooming process and the sexual acts themselves.
Yeah, I think you're right. And unfortunately, these boys had to endure that in silence and in shame. And they explained pretty well why they sort of put up with it, because what they were getting in return, they thought that Michael Jackson really loved them. And it wasn't until they saw that they were shelved, put on the side, and then picked off the shelf whenever he needed them and put back on the shelf, thrown away. And he had his new toy boy. He had his new child to sexually victimize. And they saw this over and over, and eventually it sank into them. It hurt them terribly.
Oh, and that's so horrible. And what do you make of this whole fake marriage ceremony that he has?
Wow. Talk about rationalization. Again, it is a way for him to feel, for Michael to feel, that I am doing something good. I am in love with this boy. This boy is in love with me. Therefore, this is fine. This is not bad. This is not that illegal thing, that abusive thing that other people do, these offenders do. And so what he does is, not only does he help himself feel good about this, he makes Jimmy Safechuck feel like he's committed to him. Like Michael Jackson is by his side forever. And Jimmy's over the moon about this.
and importantly makes him feel very special. You know, that special bond, I think, is so important because it's intoxicating. You know, particularly when you're talking about children, here's this megastar focusing in on these boys.
One child.
Yeah, they're the center of the world. And that, you know, you probably remember the Hawaii trip, you know, where what was your favorite part? Well, my favorite part was being with you, with Jimmy, making him feel so special. And that part of, you know, we all want to feel special, right? It doesn't matter what age we are. We all want to feel seen and heard and special. But when you've got a megastar, your idol, saying that, I mean, I can imagine it was just so intoxicating, and it just creates that further dependency. He set the ground, the groundwork. I mean, he was so smart in the way that he did it. But of course, we have to remember these are still children. They're not adults like us discussing it. They're children without the vocabulary, without the language, without a frame of reference, without knowing that these sexual acts are crimes and abuse.
Right. And here's the thing, though. As a child, when you're a child, you think, because this is the oldest you've ever been, you think you're aware. You think you're adult-like. You think you're completely in control of what you're doing. It's only when you're older that you can look back and say, oh, look how foolish I was. Look how much I didn't know back then. And so in the moment, you feel responsible for your own actions. And that's why the laws have been written across this country and around the world in most civilized countries. There are laws that protect children from their own immaturity, from their own lack of development. And so we protect children because we know that there are offenders who will take advantage of them when they're vulnerable.
Dan Reed, the producer and director of Leaving Neverland. Dan, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, a lot of people are talking about this film before it even debuts on television. You know, it's interesting that it is having such an effect because, in some sense, we've heard these stories for years about Michael Jackson. What was it about your telling that you think is so compelling?
I think it's because we have direct testimony from the little boys or the young men now who actually suffered the abuse. Once I'd interviewed Wade and James, which I did at great length, I then went and tried to find anything in the record, in the investigations of 1993 and of 2003 to 2005, anything that would contradict or undermine their story, and I couldn't find anything.
So, yeah, there was always another boy, and every 12 months, a new boy appears on the scene. And again, such a clever tactic, because now the original, whether it's Wade or whether it's Jimmy, feels rejected and feels hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just heartbreaking seeing that. But then when you see the images, and you mentioned it, Lisa, I've seen those images before, you know, him walking around with a boy, like they're lovers, in air quotes. You know, they're intimate video footage or pictures of them. That's like they're in a relationship or a couple. We've all seen those. Why weren't alarm bells ringing even with that? Unbelievable, the conflict it creates. You know, and that's what you see for me when I'm watching Wade and I'm watching Jimmy. I see that conflict in them. I see the fact that throughout all of this, they still loved him, you know, being rejected and being hurt. We all remember our first love and our first breakup, but this is it on an even more intense scale, you know, and they're still coming to terms that they had their own agency in this, that they were part of it. And that creates a conflict too, because they still loved Michael Jackson despite everything.
Yeah, it was love, it was shame, and it was fear, and that creates silence. And just watching it, I mean, I had a couple of panic attacks. I had to stop watching it. And I felt shame. I felt guilty that I was so repulsed by what these men were describing. You know, I was repulsed by what had happened to them, but I felt shame for them too. It's so fucked up. I mean, it's so needless.
And so emotionally toxic and corrosive to the soul, because that shame, I think people really underestimate the power of shame and how it maintains your silence, because you feel that it's something that you had agency in, you were part of. And that's why you get all this, I'm going to call it messiness, around when someone reports and their behavior, and it's not just clear cut from A to B to C. It's confusing and it's messy. And in this case, it is. And if it wasn't, I would be asking questions about it because it wouldn't feel authentic and right.
Right. You're right. That's a great point, Laura, because it is the messiness of it. It is the unpredictability of it and the complicated nature of it that actually makes it very truthful, that it indicates that these are emotions and warring factions. And I think there's never been a more public demonstration of the ambivalence that's created when someone is being sexually manipulated, sexually molested, and sexually groomed, because the grooming process is providing things that they need in their life and they would never dream of getting in their life, but it's being given to them at a cost. And that cost is the sexual victimization. When you were talking about images, Laura, there is no more haunting image in that first episode of Leaving Neverland than the final image that Dan Reed leaves us with. And that is Michael Jackson walking through Neverland, holding an umbrella, and he's got his arm around Gavin Arvizo. And Gavin has just a few hairs in his head because he is in the process or just recently gone through chemo. So this kid who's fighting for his life, so vulnerable, so vulnerable. And Michael Jackson is there just preying on him, pouncing on this vulnerable kid and taking advantage of him. And that ripped my heart out. Mm. It killed me to see that, because I know what Gavin didn't know at that point. I know what he was going to go through, what he went through, and the vilification he received from people after being sexually victimized over a period of time, after just barely surviving cancer. It's just outrageous. When if Michael Jackson was a decent human being that everybody thought he was, he would have taken care of Gavin and he would have made him strong again and he would have sent him on his way. But no, he had to groom him and manipulate him and sexually victimize him and then lie about it and drive him into the ground so he could jump up on a car and wave to his fans. And that's disgusting.
It is. His attention came at a real price. So many victims paid that price. And I'm sure we're going to be hearing from more and more people coming forward. I know it's just been reported that another 11 victims have come forward. And I think, Jim, what you said at the very start, it's such a shame that we're now in this knowledge. And of course, Michael Jackson cannot be held to account. And it's very reminiscent of what happened with Jimmy Savile, a children's entertainer in the UK, where exactly the same happened. You might recall.
Yes.
Celebrity, no one believed the fact that he was abusing children. He went into hospitals and abused children there. And it came out he'd been spoken to numerous times by different police forces, and no one joined these dots. So, you know, I would ask and urge everybody listening to this. This is happening in our schools. This is happening in families. This is happening everywhere, in churches. So don't think that this happens in a vacuum. And I remember you, Jim, at the FBI making a point in a classroom saying, if someone spends more time with your child than you do and wants to, you have to ask questions about that. That's a huge warning sign. And we see that played out time and time again, because this is happening in plain sight. This is not underground stuff. Michael Jackson was doing this openly and blatantly, parading it in front of everyone. And he groomed many, many people in that process. We believe what he was saying.
Right. And what makes it disgusting is that there are millions of good people on this earth who do actually love children, who do actually take care of children, who do not even think about sexually victimizing them. It is not the fact that he loves children. It's the fact that he loves children, surrounds his life with children, excludes age-appropriate adults from his life and from relationships, and latches on to these kids and then doesn't let go. for a period of time, but then when he gets tired of them, and that's episode 2 of Leaving Neverland. So next time when we come back, we'll talk about the second half of this incredibly disturbing documentary, and we'll answer questions that have been put forth from people out there who still believe Michael Jackson never molested a single person.
And just to say that we did give a caveat about just what the content of this podcast, but if you haven't seen Leaving Neverland yet, it can be triggering. So please bear that in mind. And the reason why I talked about the sexual acts in particular, and to the point that Dan Reed covered it, is because we have to understand the nature of what we're talking about. And it's so important that we hear those accounts. That is the reality of this subject. And if we don't talk about it, it just gets swept and hidden under the carpet. And I know, Jim and Lisa, you feel strongly about that as well.
Absolutely.
It was incredibly difficult to watch. I was in tears watching it. It is just so corrosive and heavy on the soul. And for Wade and for Jimmy and others to be carrying this burden is just unconscionable and unforgivable of Michael Jackson placing that burden on them and dividing everybody on this subject. To me, it's very plain and simple. When I watch their accounts, it's authentic, there's veracity, it's specific, it's detailed. I see the pain etched on their faces. I see the conflict, all the messiness that goes with it. There are no indications that this did not happen. And so people debating it and saying, well, they did X or Y, and we're going to get into that in part two. Yes, they probably did do all those things because it's part of the whole corrosive, toxic nature of abuse.
Right. Absolutely. Till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.